Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whether we view addicts with sympathy or disdain, we generally assume their problems relate to their lack of self-control. But what if the cycle of addiction actually begins with self-control? New research suggests that some people may develop addictions precisely because they are able to draw on reserves of willpower that allow them to feed their destructive habits. If that's true, does it mean addicts could harness that same willpower to resist the cravings that keep them hooked? Roy F. Baumeister joins us to talk about this. He's professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University, and he published an article in the April issue of Scientific American called Conquer Yourself, Conquer the World. Roy, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Great to be back.
All right, so we spent decades trying to build self-esteem because that seemed to correlate with success, but we got cause and effect mixed up.
That, yes, I was on that bandwagon too. I spent a lot of time studying self-esteem, and while it's interesting, and yes, people with high versus low self-esteem do differ in interesting ways, raising self-esteem does not appear to be a cause of better behavior. It did not make children into better students or better citizens or happier, healthier, much else. Maybe happier.
What do we know about the relationship between self-control and positive life outcomes?
There, the evidence is much stronger. Let me put it this way. People know that just because things go together doesn't mean that one causes the other. We saw children with high self-esteem were getting better grades, and that made us think, oh, okay, well, let's boost everybody's self-esteem, and then everybody will learn better. But the high self-esteem seems like it was more the result of the grades rather than the cause. When you track people over time, you can see what comes first. And there's where self-control really began to shine, when people started looking at these things over time. Self-control measured early in life predicts good outcomes decades later, and these have a very impressive range. People with good self-control both are better in their work and their schooling, earn more money, better grades, all those things, but also socially, better relationships, more popular, better liked by teachers, by peers. Other people trust them more. They have more reliable and durable relationships. And then physical and mental health, likewise. People with good self-control live longer, if we go all the way to the far end of life. In between, all sorts of behavioral benefits. They eat better. They are less likely to fall into various kinds of behavior problems, less likely to be arrested.
Hmm. How do scientists define self-control? Is it different from what average people walking around, from the way we understand self-control?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how how ordinary people all understand it. But no, I think the basic concept is quite similar. Scientists have favored the term self-regulation because we're always leery about taking on terms that are too widely used in the general population because they have other connotation baggage. And I like the term regulate because it means to change yourself, change your response, but also change based on an idea. It's not just change it no matter what. So for example, when the government says it's going to regulate how buildings are built or something, it doesn't just say do it different, but it says, no, you have to build the building according to these standards. There have to be windows in every room, and the heating and cooling systems have to work, and the toilets have to flush, and so on and so forth. So in the same way, regulating yourself means to change yourself, change your responses based on an idea of what you want to achieve or how long you want to go or you want to be as good as others or moral principles or expectations of parents or whatever. But it's a changing yourself based on an idea.
You liken self-control or self-regulation to a muscle. It can be strengthened by regular workouts, but inevitably it gets worn out after heavy use. How does that work?
Well, that's been a big theme of our research. We discovered fairly early that after people exert self-control on one task, if we give them another self-control task, they do worse than, say, a control condition people that skip the first task. So it looks like, as with a muscle, you're making it tired on the first task, and so you don't have as much energy in it to function well on the second task. The muscle analogy has a couple other virtues. We also find with self-control that if you exercise regularly over a time, your self-control in general gets stronger. It's not just whatever you're working on, but it's like the muscle itself. So in the first study we did some time ago, we had people work on their posture just as a self-control exercise. And so they're supposed to, whenever you think of it, sit up straight, stand up straight. And they did that for a couple of weeks, after which we brought them back to the laboratory, gave them a self-control test that had nothing to do with posture, but they improved. They were better at it. And there are about a dozen published studies that have showed similar results. It's not just what you exercise. It makes the muscle stronger so you can tackle any sort of self-control challenge better.
Which explains why, for one thing, when things get worn out, you know, we can pass by the bowl of M&Ms on a coworker's desk five times, and after we've said no five times, sometimes it's impossible to say no to, you know, the sixth time we pass by. But we do all have, and this is really interesting, the ability to sort of summon a burst of self-control even when we would seem to have exhausted our ability to self-regulate.
Yes, initially, we thought these effects were that your energy is just gone, but it doesn't seem to be that it's gone. And indeed, it seems to be tied into the body's energy source with glucose stores from food you've eaten and so on. And that certainly people in modern life are nowhere close to running out of that. So the effects are conservation effects. And this, too, is like a muscle. If you're doing some physical work, you don't usually go until your muscles are full blast. You don't go until your muscles are totally exhausted and you can't do anymore. But rather, you start to conserve and start to cut back. But that means if something important comes along, you have plenty of strength and you can respond to it. And it's the same with self-control, that people will start to show these effects that they depleted their willpower. But they can suck it up, so to speak, and perform well if there's a good reason to do so.
Maybe think about, you know, people who've raised a newborn and, you know, after a certain point, you know, they're not showering, they're not really going out of the house very often. But if that baby cries in the middle of the night, they're going to have what it takes to get up and take care of the baby.
I think that's generally true.
All right. So let's talk about this idea with addiction. For some time now, we have looked at addiction as a problem that arises among individuals who somehow lack the ability to self-regulate. How did scientists start thinking we might actually have that wrong?
Well, I think that much is probably correct. I think people with poor self-control are more susceptible to addiction. It's just recently some of us started to look at the other side of things, and you do have to exert self-control in order to sustain an addiction successfully and even often to get started. It's not easy. Most people do not like their first taste of a cigarette or of beer or of anything like that, and they overcome that, which is a self-control act. They overcome their aversion because they want to go along with their friends, or they want to try out the new experience, or for whatever reasons, motivate people to get started. So it takes some self-control often to push yourself to do the first step. Some people are often positively scared, if we're talking about especially more serious drugs. But as I said, it's just the fact that you don't like the cigarettes or the alcohol is enough the reason not to do it unless you push yourself to give it a try. And then I think particularly people who can sustain an addiction over a long period of time, that I think takes a fair amount of self-control, and people with a poor self-control are more likely to crash and burn. And, for example, if you're, well, you can look at it as something, a mild addiction, or a mild isn't perhaps the right term, but a socially acceptable one like cigarette smoking, or a seriously controversial one like heroin addiction. With cigarettes, you need a fair amount of discipline to manage your habit these days, because so many places you're not allowed to smoke. There are restrictions. Even obtaining the cigarettes can be difficult. So you need a lot of planning and management. And this afternoon I will need a cigarette at around 2 o'clock, so I have to make a break in my appointment schedule and then go outside to the park or something where I'm allowed to smoke it. Thus, we find sustaining that over a long period of time, that takes a discipline. And if we're talking about something much more intense, such as a heroin addiction, well, if you're going to maintain any kind of job and family life and just manage to keep your addiction on the side, that's going to take a lot of self-control to keep it from ruining your life. Now, many addicts fail at this point, and they just the addiction does indeed destroy their work prospects or their family or their close relationships. So that's not there. But we need to recognize that lots of people do manage these things successfully. Indeed, the norm, I understand, for a heroin addiction is to become addicted in your early 20s and to stop being addicted in your late 20s, usually without external help. Many of them do it on their own. The ones we become familiar with are sort of the more hopeless cases who show up in these medical treatment centers and go on and on there, and they've sort of given the impression that addiction is a hopeless life sentence. But that may be specific to the people in that group, and they may be atypical. Lots of people do quit addictions on their own.
There was a study a few months ago that found that a majority of people that might be defined in terms of their behavior as either alcoholics or abusive drinkers are not actually physiologically addicted, which would seem like a hopeful sign, but they are still, using alcohol abusively. What have you learned about the nature of the cravings that drive addictive use of substances?
Well, this is an area where the research is embedded in some controversy. I think we've all, to some extent, embraced the popular stereotype that addicts' cravings just get stronger and stronger and eventually are overwhelming, and the addict loses any free will and becomes a slave to the drug or the habit. And yet more and more data are piling up suggesting that that's not true, that if anything, the cravings don't particularly increase. We have the most data, I think, on smoking because it's just easiest for researchers to study. The cravings, smokers believe if I were to stop smoking right this minute, my cravings would just steadily increase and get stronger and stronger, and I would be eventually overwhelmed by them. When they actually do that experiment, the craving drops. It fluctuates some, but it rarely gets as high as it was beforehand. And they're very nice controlled studies showing this. Even in our own data, we looked at the desires people have, and the people who reported desires for tobacco or alcohol, these were on average the weakest desires that that people reported in our of all the different desires that people said they were having. So it seems that the craving, rather than thinking of it as this monster overwhelming drive that blots out everything else and forces you to do something, rather it's more like a recurrent bad habit, and your body gets used to finding pleasure in this way and thinks, oh yeah, wouldn't it be nice to have a cigarette, and wouldn't it be nice to have a cigarette, and those come up perhaps fairly often.
We're speaking this hour with Roy F. Baumeister. He's professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University, and he published an article in the April issue of Scientific American called Conquer Yourself, Conquer the World. We'll talk more about self-regulation, willpower, and self-control in a few minutes. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Roy F. Baumeister, professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University and author of an article in the April Scientific American called Conquer Yourself, Conquer the World. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Roy, let's go back to talking about something like nicotine addiction. You said that the cravings, people assume when they quit smoking or using tobacco that the cravings will get stronger and stronger, that they sort of wax and wane throughout the day, as it turns out. Why then is it so hard for people who really want to stop using this stuff to break the habit?
Yes, well, that's a good question. Quitting smoking is sort of the graveyard of psychological theories. Very little seems to work. One of the papers, Michael Syed has been a leader in this, and one of the things he found is the cravings get weaker when you quit, but they switch from being pleasant to unpleasant, and that changes the calculation. Because if you're smoking regularly and you're not trying to quit or anything, and then you feel like having a cigarette, and you think, oh, well, that would feel good. And so then you have a cigarette, and it does feel good. And so you have this little sequence of pleasures dotting your day. Now, when you decide you're not going to smoke anymore, you get this urge for a cigarette, but it's unpleasant. This is an aversive thing. And that kind of perhaps intensifies the idea that, well, if I did have a cigarette, I would feel good. And you know, feeling bad makes that perhaps more appealing. We find, too, that people are reasonably good at quitting smoking, at least for a time. But where it breaks down is, you know, when they're feeling especially bad, stressed out, other demands and things, or when their self-control is weak, either again, possibly because of stress or other sorts of demands. Now, to go back to my own work on self-control, your willpower, your ability to control yourself, this is something that fluctuates through the day. Yes, some people are better than others, so it's not completely random or anything like that. But your ability to resist temptation and so on, this goes up and down. So we have inside the smoker, you think the craving is going up and down kind of randomly. It's not high, but it's often there in the background and pops up repeatedly. And as I said, it's kind of unpleasant. And, you know, if you had the cigarette, it'd be positive. Meanwhile, also fluctuating is your willpower. So if you catch a moment when the craving's a little bit stronger than usual and the willpower is low, that's probably the danger spot. Researchers have tried to track the course of withdrawal from cigarette smoking and so on, and different people have different patterns and so on. But that probably suggests there are two different things fluctuating there. So the moment at which you you succumb is a moment of weakness in a fairly literal sense, and that your self-control might happen to be low. Then you just struggled to do something difficult at work, or strained for a emotionally difficult conversation with a loved one, or whatever. So your self-control is low at the moment, and if that also happens to be one of the stronger moments of a craving, then maybe it just doesn't seem worth it to fight that too and to resist that. Once people start to lapse, lapse predicts relapse pretty well, as I understand. I recently read an experimental study where they had people quit smoking, and then half of them were randomly assigned to have one cigarette. After that, they relapsed much faster than others. People think, if I could just have one, maybe that would satisfy me for a while. But it seems to rekindle the taste and the body's memory and the brain's memory that this was a source of pleasure.
So is it true, once an addict, always an addict, whether using or not?
I don't know. I don't think there's a strong justification for that in the data. You know, there are clearly people who have quit smoking and quit drugs and so forth and never do it again. There are other people, though. You know, it seems like once the body's discovered that this is a source of pleasure, it learns that again fairly easily. So, if, say you smoked regularly and then quit for 20 years, but if you started smoking again, you might become addicted faster than others because your body will you'll quickly relearn this is a source of pleasure. But yeah, the once an addict, always an addict, I don't know. I mean, our assumption held that, and the first big blow to that was the studies by Lee Robbins and group on the Vietnam veterans coming back after the war in Vietnam, and many American servicemen were seriously addicted to heroin over there. When they came back to the United States, most of them were able to just drop the addiction just like that, and did not have struggles or relapses or withdrawal problems. There may have been some withdrawal, though. Heroin withdrawal is not as bad as it looks in the movies, apparently.
Well, that's a good thing.
Some of them reportedly were even able to use heroin occasionally without becoming re-addicted. I've just read secondhand summaries of that research and that finding. But that was such a shock to our field's understanding of addiction, because we assumed, oh, God, these young men, once they get hooked on something, they are there for life. But it was really tied to that specific situation. Stanton Peale has a line in one of his books that people with better things to do don't get addicted. And so soldiers are over in Vietnam and doing guard duty or something that's very dull and it's dangerous, and heroin helped them cope with a very difficult situation. But, you know, if they came back to the U.S. and suddenly had better things to do, found a girlfriend and got a job and started a life, then the appeal of heroin was not there in the way that it was while they were on duty in the dangerous war zone.
Okay, then, Roy, if it takes a modicum of self-regulation, self-control to develop and maintain some kind of addiction, can we harness that in order to quit?
We probably do have to harness self-control in order to quit. It doesn't happen without some degree of effort. Whether that's linked to what you used to become addicted in the first place, I don't know. I think you're asking, does the process of becoming addicted count as an exercise that will strengthen your self-control? And I don't know. I guess I'm a little skeptical about that. I think people don't push themselves that hard to the way they might. To become addicted to a substance the way they might push themselves to develop an exercise program or be more responsible or something like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Craig in Dallas. Hi, Craig.
Hi. Just had two quick questions. The first one.
Craig, are you with us? Okay, Craig has... We've disconnected from him accidentally. Let's go instead to Sharon in Arlington. Hi.
Hi. My question kind of deals with another guest that you had on your show at one time. And they talked about, I think it was your show, I know it was NPR, but they talked about addiction being one of a compulsion, kind of like a compulsion theory that they talked about. And Professor Baumeister kind of touched on it. People with better things to do don't get addicted. And one of the compulsion theories was such that people tend to do things that take less effort. So say you're at work and you're not liking your boss. And so instead of dealing with the issue with your boss, their compulsion is to go smoke a cigarette, or the compulsion may be to eat something. It's like you eat your feelings. So instead of dealing with the issue at hand, we tend to do something that's, less effort. But yet it's one of those things that become addicting, but it's a compulsion to do it instead of dealing with the issue. Does that make sense? And he framed that around addiction and being a compulsion more so than, because he was saying we over-medicate addiction in the sense of saying that it's something that is a disease. And he said maybe we've gone too far into it being a disease as opposed to something that is a compulsion. And once you fix the issue, you can fix the compulsion.
What do you think about that, Roy?
Okay, very interesting comment. I haven't heard the other show that to which she was referring. Idea that we've overstated the disease model of addiction, I think there's a lot of agreement with that in the research community on addiction, that it's not a disease like other diseases. If you look at Alcoholics Anonymous or one of those things, there are very few diseases where people get better by going and talking about this with other people who have the disease. That much is true. The term compulsion is used mostly by psychologists to refer to a really strong something that drives behavior, if anything, outside your control. On that, my sense is the changes that addiction produces are not in the control of your movements the way a compulsion might be, but it affects the wanting part, the desire centers in the brain. Essentially, the brain learns this is a new way to get really good pleasure, and so wants to switch the body to pursuing that rather than doing the more traditional things. But the addict retains control. You can decide what you do. The cigarettes don't light themselves and force themselves into your mouth, and it's not like you're struggling with one hand to push away the other hand holding the cigarette. Indeed, as I said, to smoke cigarettes these days, you need to plan and execute very carefully so as to obey the various rules and restrictions on smoking. The other interesting point that she made was that you might turn to addiction as a way of not dealing with other problems. So if you're at work, I think she said you have a problem with your boss, you don't want to deal with the boss, so instead you go and smoke or take drugs or whatever. And this, I think, is an important point. It goes back to people having better things to do don't get addicted as much. When the people who are in difficult life circumstances for which drugs are their way of coping, they are very poor prospects for recovery. That's been well documented with cigarettes and with harder drugs too. The people in these treatment programs, hospitals and so forth, most of the research is on them, but they turn out to have other psychological and personal problems. So you can get them cleaned up and get them off the drugs or the cigarette or whatever, then you send them back to their messed up life where smoking, using drugs is their way of coping, and so they relapse. And that's what's given the impression that addiction is permanent and incurable, and it's just a matter of you can get it to subside for a while, but it's likely to come back. However, other people in other circumstances do much better. Actually, there's some interesting, promising work suggesting that if you want to quit anything from smoking to other sorts of addictions, changing your circumstances becomes good. Some studies that people did better quitting smoking on vacation, and you think, vacation, I'm supposed to be having a good time. But there are a couple advantages of vacation. One is, for one thing, you're not using up all your self-control and willpower to deal with the stresses at work or anything. But also you're in a different place. What happens when you smoke, and I think it's the same for using drugs or video games or whatever, that pleasure becomes associated with that place. So if you want to make the best of a chance to quit smoking, move to a new apartment or new house or whatever and say, I'm not going to smoke here. If I ever do have to smoke, I'll go outside or whatever. And then there are no associations in the house. But just to bring this, illustrate this in another way, I talked to a colleague who said, we are professors, and we spend much of our time sitting at a computer writing articles to try to publish in the scientific journals. And he said he always smoked cigarettes while he's sitting at his desk writing his papers, and this just became part of his life. You would think about these ideas and the statistics you have to work with and what you can say and so on, and sit there and have a cigarette. And this was very – and then he decided he had to quit. But he still had to write papers and still had to sit at that computer. So that made work much more difficult because he had to go to the same place and do those same things. At least you got to move to a new office or something like that to help break those cues, which set off the reaction in the mind that, oh, yeah, wouldn't it be nice to have a cigarette?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Craig in Dallas. Hi, Craig.
Hi, just a quick question touching on something that you mentioned a few times now. You make the interesting point that smokers and people who are sort of working with a habit that has some degree of social control or regulatory aspects around it have to expend a significant amount of willpower just to keep that habit going. Is there any evidence on what effect those regimes might have on people's ability to quit? In other words, do people say, you know, it's difficult to smoke, I've got to go here, I have these time constraints, it's just not worth it? Or does the expenditure of discipline and willpower actually draw them down where it might be harder for them to quit?
That much, we don't have that kind of data available yet. One piece, though, that's relevant is a paper by Michael Daly that's currently under review. He looked at what happened in the Netherlands when they banned smoking in the offices, and that was, I think, in 2004. It was fairly recent. So they looked at the course of things, and they were able to separate people with high versus low self-control. So what seems to have happened is the ban forbidding people to smoke in their offices reduced the smoking mainly among people with low self-control. And that effect was temporary, and it wore off after a couple of years, and then they were back like the others. And the explanation, we think, is that people with high self-control were able to adjust to the new rules and figure out how to continue smoking. People with poor self-control weren't able to do it, so they just stopped smoking at the office until they copied what the other people were doing and say, oh, yeah, okay, no, now I can know. There's an afternoon break and we could smoke outside and so on. But the short-term effect was too much for them.
We're speaking to Roy F. Baumeister, professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University, about his new Scientific American article. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Roy F. Baumeister, published an article in the April issue of Scientific American entitled Conquer Yourself, Conquer the World. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University, and the article is about new research into self-regulation and what it can do for us. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Roy, I'd like to switch gears here and talk for a minute about emotional self-regulation. This is something we all have to learn, and part of it is not acting on every impulse, but also part of it is, you know, sort of keeping our emotions under the surface in particular situations. And this helps us to be successful at work and school and to be more popular in some situations where we maybe think an unpleasant thought, but we don't have to articulate it. On the other hand, lots of people in your profession would tell us that it's very dangerous to keep our emotions bottled up. And so I wonder if there are two sides to that same coin, or how you think about the value and potential danger of emotional self-regulation.
Oh, I'm a firm believer in controlling your emotions. I think that's part of the process of growing up.
Being civilized, right?
Yes, being a civilized human being. It's something we teach our children, and for very good reason. The the idea that it's dangerous to bottle up your emotions, so this is something sort of one of the late Freudian ideas, but the evidence for it is surprisingly weak. There isn't much evidence. Mostly, when people control, as in stifle their emotions, the emotions actually become weaker and go away, and there's no apparent harm done. So this idea that if you're angry at your partner, you owe it to yourself to yell at them or to express this, you know, this is not correct. It's going to be bad for the relationship. And it's probably not going to do you any good. And in fact, venting your emotions, letting them out and so on, tends to make them stronger. Obviously, with something like joy or love or whatever, we don't have a lot of trouble controlling those. But if we look, say, to anger, which is a very important special case, expressing your anger tends to make you angrier again. Holding your tongue tends to make the anger go away. What's bad, and what I think what gave it the negative stereotype is when people stay mad over a long period of time but still don't say it. It looks like the staying mad is the nasty part, not the failing to express it. But there's very little evidence that venting it, either through saying something or doing something, that does any good. It also includes, taking a bat and beating a pillow or something like that. That does not seem to cause the anger to subside anyway. Psychologists have tested this over and over again, and there's not much to be said in favor of, venting your angry emotions.
This is so interesting. I have not heard that perspective before, but it's fascinating. All right. So we all know people who seem to be firing on all cylinders, right? They take great care of their bodies. They are in control of, things at work, and they have good relationships. It does seem like a lot of people, though, have this Achilles heel of self-regulation. You know people who would never miss a day at the gym, but they can't manage their finances, or they can't manage to get, places on time or whatever. What do we know about why self-control seems to have like pockets of weakness for particular individuals?
Okay, that's a good point. There are a couple things to say. First of all, you mentioned impulse control and emotion control. I want to add two others. People also use some self-control over their thoughts, and they use a fair amount over their performance, to make themselves go to work and persevere, keep working when you feel like quitting, persist in the face of failure. So a lot of self-control is used also for maximizing your job performance. Viewed in that way, you can understand that there are a lot of different demands on a given person's self-control and willpower. The research so far indicates that it's the same energy, the same willpower, the same control that's used for all these different things. So in principle, if you have good self-control, you should be good at all these things, except that it's limited. You only have so much, and so you put it into some things more than others. And you may decide you'll put it into, like you said, managing work and beating the deadlines and balancing the checkbook, but and then it doesn't get devoted to getting haircuts on time or keeping your home clean, things like that. So it's not, again, it's consistent with the idea you have a limited stock of it, and you kind of choose what's important to devote that to.
Does willpower get stronger as we get older?
That's a good question, and the answer is not clear. It looks like people have fewer self-control problems as they get older, although some kinds of mental control things seem to get some inhibitions get weaker when one really does start going into old age. So certainly if we start from childhood going up through adolescence and adulthood and so on, I think we know the picture that the amount of self-control does have to develop to reach adult levels. That's the crisis of adolescence. This goes back to Freud, and he was right about this, that The problem is you have an adult's desires but a child's self-control. So it might have been a perfectly well-behaved child for the first 10 years, but now it has to manage a much stronger volcano of impulses. And so as adolescence wears on, the capacity for self-control kind of catches up and is able to manage it. Now, you're saying what happens when we get older. The difficulty for the researcher is that the antisocial impulses get much weaker. So if you look at, say, controlling sexual and aggressive impulses, well, they're much easier to control in your 50s than in your 20s. We certainly know from abundant data on crime and so forth that that's crime is a young man's game, and people don't seem to start a life of crime after age 30, anything like that. So if we think of the behavior as a product of the impulse and the control or the restraint of it, you're asking, do the restraints get weaker? Well, the impulses get weaker. Whether the restraints also get stronger, it's hard to get an objective measure of that that we can separate from the fact that you're just not feeling like doing the bad stuff the way you used to be. And as I said, then too, what happens when you get older? Old people are more likely to say the wrong thing or blurt out comments that are inappropriate or prejudiced or whatever. Some of those inhibitions don't operate as efficiently in old age, probably because of changes in the brain. I don't know as much about that, but there are some good papers on that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Erica on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Erica.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. I've often heard it said that food addiction is the hardest addiction of all addictions to beat. And actually, I've heard that in OA because I suffer from food addiction. And my question is this, is there any research to back that up? I mean, the thought is usually, food addiction is something that you have to take out. It's like a lion in a cage that you have to take out and walk it three times a day and then try to put it back in there at the end of the day, whereas narcotics or any other type of addiction is not necessarily that way. Is there any research to back up that thought? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. This is a great question. It's only somewhat recently that people have begun to talk about food as an addiction and that some people get addicted to various eating patterns. And comparing the difficulty of breaking an addiction is hard. What kind of external criterion are you going to use? You can use the obvious one. Do they ever consume the behavior again? And, well, yes, people quit smoking and never smoke again, but they can't stop eating and never eat again. and that complicates certainly not only the research question, but also the process that you cannot really live without food, whereas you can live without a lot of the other things that people get addicted to, including both drugs and cigarettes and things like that, as well as behavioral addictions like video games and gambling. You can really cut them out of your life entirely, which you cannot do with food. A further issue coming from our research that makes food an especially difficult addiction to address is that food is the source of the energy that fuels your self-control and fuels your willpower. I don't think we talked about this much in the Scientific American, but in the book I have called Willpower, we review some of this, that it's sort of like a catch-22, to use the old Joseph Heller novel title, that in order to quit eating or to control your eating, you need to have willpower, but in order to have the energy for willpower, you need to eat. So starving yourself of food takes away precisely what you need for self-control. And whereas with quitting anything else, you can just make sure to eat healthy and proper food so that at least your system has the energy to exert the self-control that it needs to resist those other impulses.
If we are trying to externally motivate someone else to get control over a troublesome behavior, do rewards work better than punishments or vice versa?
that's good. It depends a little bit on who else we're trying to motivate and so forth, whether we're trying to teach a child or encourage a friend or whatever. So you have to consider other aspects of the relationship. Rewards are often preferred because people rather be praised than criticized. And so punishments, negative things can have a bad effect on the relationship. But if you're just asking the technical question, what works better, rewards or punishments, the evidence suggests that punishment is slightly stronger than reward. And I know this goes against what we prefer to believe with everything from schools and so forth. We want to get rid of all negative feedback and provide only positive feedback. The maximum learning, no question, comes from both. If you want to teach a child or an adult or anything, giving the most information is the most effective for learning. So reward the positive and punish the negative. If you're wanting to use just one or the other, well, then you're losing half of your arsenal or half of your tools. But the evidence suggests that punishment is a little bit more effective than reward. But then you want to balance that, as I said, against the negative effects on the relationship from criticizing. So I think most people would probably fall back on with a friend, lover, would fall back on mainly relying on praise and keeping the criticism to themselves. So that's probably going to be the weakest of the various possibilities. It's most effective to use both.
Roy, I'm asking this sincerely. Does, really immersing yourself in all of this research and learning, year by year, more and more about the subject, do you and your colleagues, do you feel like it's fair to say you have more ability to self-regulate than the average person walking around because you have the data behind you?
I don't. I'm not in the habit of analyzing myself here.
And if it's too personal, you don't have to answer. But
I would say yes, that the certainly the data do help. It's one reason I wrote that book. I don't know if I'm allowed to mention it on the show.
Sure. We had you on the show when you had the book out. Sure.
Okay. And we've gotten lots of emails from people saying that, that really helped them, that getting the information, understanding how self-control works, and understanding that everything you do all day, even if it's just putting off going to the bathroom for an hour, that's going to use up your self-control, and then that might make you weaker in terms of resisting the cigarette or saying the wrong thing to someone else. So understanding how they're related, understanding the daily patterns, all this information. I'm a firm believer in science, and that knowing the truth is generally helpful and sometimes quite helpful, and it was our goal. Was to try to make the science available to people who can use it in their own lives. And so, yes, I do believe it works. Whether I myself am a paragon of this, I wouldn't venture to say.
We have spent this hour with Roy F. Baumeister, professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University. He had a piece in Scientific American in April called Conquer Yourself, Conquer the World. His book is called Willpower. Roy, it was a pleasure to have you on again. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you again for having me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And if you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.